There was a time when the only place to get a book was to buy it from a store or to borrow it from a library. Now, in two clicks, we can read it on an iPad. Do we still need libraries? This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. According to the Pew Research Center, about a quarter of American adults say they have not read a book in any form in the past year. Of those that do read, they're increasingly using tablet computers and their cell phones in addition to e-readers like Kindle. What's the future role for libraries in today's digital landscape? But first, let's take a look at the past. Industrialist Andrew Carnegie made a fortune in the steel industry and then gave it away to charity, including building a public library system throughout the country. His stipulation? The libraries had to be public, they had to be free to everyone, and they had to look imposing, like the temples of learning that they were. Between 1886 and 1919, Carnegie's donations paid for 1,679 libraries in big cities and small towns. Carnegie built just 10 public libraries in Florida, of which six are still standing. One of them is in Palmetto, and I went there to take a tour.
My name is Tori Chasey Edwards, and I'm the curator of the Palmetto Historical Park here. So this Carnegie Library was the first public library built here in Palmetto in 1914. In fact, it was really the first real library in the whole county. And they had to work really hard to get it, a little bit of interesting political maneuvering to make it happen. They had this Village Improvement Association here, but they had a reading room, is what they called it. It was above a grocery store or a, you know, dry goods store right here on Old Main. It was too small. It was too small for the city and the needs that they had. But they moved it into City Hall, where the mayor and all the bigwigs in town were literally tripping over the fact that we need a bigger room for this. So they had this subcommittee that was, you know, the library committee. And who did they make the chair of that committee? The mayor's wife. So I like to think that there was a little small town politics in there. And in some of the letters we have, you know, here in our archive center, the letters that went back and forth between the mayor at the time and the Carnegie Foundation secretary. But at one point, there's like three letters in a row from our mayor to the Carnegie Foundation. And he says something along the lines of, you know, thinking perhaps that the letter went astray, I'm taking the liberty of writing you again. And I just keep thinking, you know, he went home that night and his wife's like, did they get back to you about the library yet? Are you going to get our library? And he's like, no, I haven't heard anything. She's like, write them again, you know? So I like to think there was a little bit of that interesting small town politics behind there. So it was built in 1914 with $10,000 from the Carnegie Foundation. One of the things they required of us is that we had to have a basement. And of course, the mayor at the time wrote back and said, you know, have you been to Florida? We don't think it's a great idea to have a basement in our library. We're going to flood, you know. So the Carnegie Foundation wrote back and basically said something along the lines that, you know, everybody else who wanted our money met our requirements, and you guys just need to figure it out. So that's why if you want to come in the front door of this building, you have to come up two separate long flights of stairs, and what's down below is a basement. Now, the basement there is only like 2.5, maybe 3 feet underground. So it qualified as a basement, but it's not in any serious danger, at least of flooding. The front door comes in right off Old Main Street, so that, you know, people could come across. And actually, if you look out there, our current public library that was built in 1969 is directly across the street from us. When this one closed in 69 and they had that one ready to be opened, I've been told that they had volunteers line up and do like a book brigade where you just pass it along to the next person. So that's how they got all the books from this one to that one. But you'll notice that we have the original hardwood floors in here. So this is, you know, 102-year-old yellow pine. They required that we had fireplaces at both ends, which we were happy to have. Not super necessary down here, but, you know, they were nice to have. This is the original desk that we had here. We have redone some of the shelves, especially the ones that needed the attention anyways, and tried to make them a little taller. But it's funny, if you look at all their books must have been awfully short. Now, I know that, you know, paper was more expensive back then. They wouldn't have had big fancy picture books and stuff like we do today. But it's really tricky today to try to utilize the shelves without laying things sideways a lot. We have the letters that go back and forth, and you can read through some of them. It's kind of funny. They were a little nitpicky about things. If they had not cared that much, maybe the library still would have been really functional and really helpful for the time that it was, you know, in use. But I bet you it still wouldn't be standing here today. You know, I can't imagine that if they hadn't made this a beautiful building where you'd want to come and, you know, kind of linger on the window seats and things like that. I think they probably would have torn it down when it wasn't useful anymore. Whereas this one, it is worth saving, and people put a lot of time and money and effort into preserving it.
I'm Robin Sussingham. Joining me here in the studio, Ava Eady is the Manatee County Public Library's service manager. She was named the 2017 Librarian of the Year by the Florida Library Association. Thanks for being here, Ava.
Thank you, Robin.
Todd Chavez is the Dean of Libraries for the University of South Florida. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you.
And from Rock Hill, South Carolina, Mark Y. Herring is the Dean of Library Services at Winthrop University and the author of the book, Are Libraries Obsolete? Welcome, Mark. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Ava, people might be surprised at all the things that librarians are doing now, the classes, the activities that librarians offer. You're doing more than just checking out books.
Well, and I think right from the get-go with Mr. Carnegie, when he began libraries, it was about education and providing culture. And I think our public libraries continue in those roles. That the way that looks just has changed.
What are some of the things that you're doing? I know you were given this award because you're bringing in more people to the public library in Bradenton. What are some of the things that you've done to bring people in?
We're working a lot with different age groups. We've always been that place that parents can come and help their child get ready for school. We're doing a lot more outreach to the community at the point of need because we realize transportation is an issue and they can't always get to our libraries physically. So we're doing a pop-up literacy station and taking that out to the community. We're also trying to help prepare some reading rooms in low-income housing facilities. We, for the teens, are working on a couple of projects. We just finished on April 22nd our fourth annual recycled teen fashion show where they use all kinds of household junk and upcycle it. And at the end of it, one of the prizes is that they get to have an opportunity to be an intern at Manatee Players over the summer in the costume department. And with our full-on grown-up family members, we're doing creative aging, so it's a 6, 8, or 10 week session on something like digital photography or ballroom dancing. They get to build new community. These are a lot of the people in our community that they are very lonely, and they're talking about the people who died and all the people that are sick. And so now they're building new community, and at the end they have a celebration. Then little Johnny and Susie, their grandkids, are coming in and seeing them in a new light rather than them always being the ones to go see their children.
Todd, you're at the USF Academic Library. You specialize in digital learning tools. What do you mean by that?
Digital file formats range from digital text to images, recordings of music and so forth, and data itself.
So did you have to increase the computer storage size? Is it turning into sort of an archive there at USF?
It is. We do use various avenues to gain and increase storage, but it's worth noting your cell phone has more storage capacity and power than all of the computers that were used during the Mercury and Apollo space launches. So computing has become very accessible, and the costs have gone down, so storage is not the issue it once was.
Mark Herring, the subtitle of your book is An Argument for Relevance in the Digital Age. So you say, yes, libraries are still relevant?
I do, yes.
And tell me why.
Well, for the longest time, libraries have been about information and passing that information on from one generation to another. And I think we're still in that business. We're just doing it in a different way. One thing that I think is important for your listeners to bear in mind is that when you're reading an academic text as opposed to a trade publication, it's a lot more difficult to comprehend what you're doing, and it requires a little more activity from reading the text. If you can imagine trying to read Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, it's hard enough to read it in paper, so much less trying to read it digitally. So you have to have both of these. It's not a question of one or the other. It's both and. And that's what we stress and what we do. One of the things we started a couple of years ago was our institutional repository. We have over 6 million items in our archive that no one could have seen up until 2 years ago. They had to come to the building in order to see this material, and most people didn't know we even had it. So it's not only in the case of materials that were never available, they're unique to a particular location. Those are becoming more available because it's accessible online. But also in the age of fake news, I think it's more important than ever that libraries are there to help guide people through what can be a thicket of different kinds of competing information that people need to have a way of ferreting their way through and finding what it is they really need to know.
Well, let's talk about the online books for a moment. I know they can help students out because they're cheaper than those expensive print textbooks. But I think some studies have indicated that the students are not reading as deeply, they're not thinking as deeply when they're using the e-books. They become more easily distracted. So should librarians be using some caution directing students to e-books? Mark?
You have to look at the kind of information that you're trying to pick up. Certainly textbooks online are much more inexpensive than print textbooks, but the question is whether or not you're retaining that information. And I think for us anyway, we're finding more and more that students prefer a print copy of something that they're having to learn from than they do a text itself. And in fact, there are some studies that indicate that this is true even nationwide, depending on what the context of the information happens to be. We also know that your eyes move differently when you're reading text than when you're reading online. When you're reading text, your eye takes in the line above and below. You don't really realize that as you're reading across it, but your brain anticipates the information that's coming in. We haven't learned to do that digitally. That's not to say we won't, but it is something that slows us down in a digital format. So it's not, again, a matter of whether or not we should do it. It is a matter of the context of the information and what has to be done with it later.
Todd, what do you think about that?
I think Mark made a very good point. It depends upon the type of reading that you're doing, the depth and level of reading. I have ebook collections over probably close to 2,000 ebooks on a single tablet, but I wouldn't want to necessarily curl up with those books. And if I were going to be deep reading, generally speaking, for the enjoyment purposes where I'm trying to relax, I'm not going to use an ebook. On the other hand, if I'm just looking for a particular piece of information, a snippet of sorts, or something that will help support an argument in the paper I'm writing, the convenience of access for ebooks, it just can't be beaten. You can search an entire book or collection or even an entire library with a very simple online search, and that's just not possible when you're dealing with print materials.
Well, that's a little bit of the worry, though, because I'm more familiar with high school students that have been living in my home with me, my sons. And I'm afraid that when they are consuming reading materials digitally, they're grabbing the information they need rather than sitting down and using their long-term concentration to read.
That's probably a legitimate concern. One of the things that I did before our conversation, I went and looked at the sale of books, including ebooks. Last year, during 2016, print sales went up 3.3%. That's the third straight year that the sales have gone up. But the most significant jump was in the area of board books for ebook sales. So what I'm saying is that there's a new generation coming online right now with reading that are starting with ebooks. And you're likely to see a change in reading behavior as that goes forward.
There is a snatch-and-grab mentality about reading digitally, and I think that is something we have to be concerned about, and particularly in the academy, we're very concerned about the potentials for plagiarism, which is running at an all-time high. It's not that people have never plagiarized, but it does seem to be escalating at a fairly alarming rate, and part of that, not all of it, but part of it, is certainly a result of being able to get information quickly, piece it together, and not be careful about citations and where it comes from.
This is Florida Matters, and we're talking about libraries in the 21st century. I'm Robin Sessingham. We'll be right back. This is Florida Matters, and we're talking about how the mission and function of libraries is changing in an increasingly digital world. I'm Robin Sessingham. Joining me to discuss this is Todd Chavez, Dean of USF Libraries, Florida's 2017 Librarian of the Year, Ava Eady with Manatee County Public Libraries. And on the phone with us from South Carolina is Mark Y. Herring, the Dean of Library Services at Winthrop University and the author of the book, Are Libraries Obsolete? Ava, let's talk about public funding for libraries. Should they be funded with taxes? From the Boston Globe, Mark Mercier of the Cooperative Library of Boxford, Massachusetts, says no. And he says, and I quote, in today's world of digital media, libraries play a different role than the one traditionally held for decades. When the costs of printed media were much higher relative to income, access was often restricted to the wealthy. Libraries were created to democratize access. Now, digital media and the Internet have dramatically expanded access at significantly less cost to the individuals who utilize them. Attempting to remain relevant, municipal libraries are adding other entertainment, often duplicating local cafes, nonprofit clubs, and community centers, with the costs being picked up by taxpayers.
I think from the public library side, I don't feel that there's necessarily a duplication. More of what I see is that our budgets are often flatlined. And in fact, what we're doing is buying a print resource, a large print, a paperback, an ebook, an e-audio, and trying to provide access to everyone equally, because we always are that piece that tries to democratize the situation for our entire community. And as the cost of the e-resources, the digital resources, goes up, for instance, a print book may cost us $30. That same book in e-book format is going to be $90.
So that's surprising, because it's less expensive to the consumers, but the libraries are having to pay for it.
Absolutely. And I think it's we've had a longstanding relationship with the print publishers, where with the e-book vendors, what they're saying is that a print book will wear out. Therefore, you can either buy it at $50 and you get 25 uses and then it just goes away, or you can buy it and actually own the item. But at that point, they feel that we are giving it to that many more people to use in the community, and therefore they are trying to justify costs that way.
Right. You're talking about reading. I'm talking about the other services that you provide that are more like a community center. When you're talking about putting on a fashion show for teenagers, you are doing things that would traditionally be done by a community center. So is this the role that the library needs to take on? Mark, do you have an opinion about this?
Well, I'm conflicted over public funding for libraries, both academic and public. It really depends, I think, on what the culture wants to have come out of it. I mean, if the federal government is going to support libraries, and the libraries are going to have to toe that line to a certain extent. So I think it really is up to the community to decide what it wants. The idea that everybody has access to electronic materials, I think, is a false one, because they do not. I mean, I live in an area in South Carolina where you don't have to go very far to see abject poverty. And those people have no access to information unless it's provided by the public library. But at the same time, I worry about what that means in terms of what the library will have to do in order to get that money.
If I can just jump back in, I think for me, the community doesn't know what the public library has now, so our first step is to get them physically in the door. Things like having computers available for somebody searching for a job or helping them with a job application. It's simply that, according to the Pew Report, a third of the people in our community don't have their own computer or internet access, and yet every single job application is available online. Social services are only available online. So we end up getting a lot of our roles defined by what the community says they need. And we respond to that in a different way. So we get them first in the door with our unusual, unique programming. And then secondarily, we get in there and show them what we can do to help them be successful in their life.
As we heard in my piece on the Carnegie Libraries, it was important to the Carnegie Foundation that the library be an imposing structure here in Florida. We had to have fireplaces and a basement, giving importance to reading and to knowledge. Ava, do you think that physical element is still important to libraries?
I think, for instance, each of our six libraries look completely different, and anything we build in the future may be completely different. We build it for the demographic area now. I think we are looking to support what the needs of that particular group in the community are. If they're migrant workers, it's going to look very different than if they are seasonal tourists. And whether we have more technology or less will be dependent upon that. And a lot of it is a space, too, a place for things to happen and to create.
And the Carnegie Foundation was making grants for the libraries. What's the budget like now? Are you under financial strain?
Absolutely. The state is right now working on things like our state aid. And for us, it is about a sixth of what it was 10 years ago, which is the primary source of our purchasing dollars for our book money. That's a huge impact.
You said one-sixth?
One-sixth. And on top of the fact that all those resources go up in price, and now, as I said, we have to buy them in a variety of formats, it's more than ever something we have to really be very, very careful about how we spend money. Most public libraries, if you meet them, they're doing the very best they can to make do with much less staff, in many fewer hours, and with fewer resources, and yet the need is greater than ever.
Todd.
We've spent quite a bit of time improving efficiency so that the number of staff, as they have declined over years with attrition, retirements, and so forth, hasn't had the negative impact on the operations. But budgets are always a difficult issue. And I can guarantee you that if you gave me $1 million right now, I can spend it for you on materials that our faculty and students would use at a very heavy level. There's just more information and more information resources and opportunities out there than there is sufficient budget.
Are you seeing some tightening of the belt in South Carolina also, Mark?
Oh, without a question. About 25 years ago, we were getting about 45% of our budget from the state of South Carolina. Next year, we'll get about 8% of our budget.
Are the local communities stepping up in Manatee County? I mean, are you getting, maybe it should be something that the community is funding rather than the state?
I think in our instance, we're very fortunate. We have a library foundation and a friends group at each of our libraries. So in addition to our budget that comes through the millage and through the state, we also have some additional help from these other organizations. But it is a community resource, but it really depends on that community if it has enough wealth to help support it well. So again, it's a case-by-case basis.
Mark, librarians seem to see themselves now on the front lines of social justice. Rebecca T. Miller, the editorial director of Library Journal and School Library Journal, writes this week that she's inspired by an idea called radical inclusivity in libraries, which she says demands a reset of our understanding of what is needed to support a democracy. Rebecca Smith Aldrich from the Mid-Hudson Library System in New York writes, "Our work is rightfully recognized as a critical component of the resistance." She says librarians are rushing to save climate data from being destroyed. So the message here is that advocating for libraries isn't enough anymore. Now that Donald Trump is president, libraries have to take a more political approach across the board. How do you see that?
Well, I think that's a recipe for disaster for libraries. I think that institutions like libraries that have been politically neutral for most of their lives to now decide to make a statement one way or the other will be, I think, the beginning of the end. It just doesn't serve anyone. Whenever you take a stand on a position that is highly controversial, you're going to lose some of the people you say you're serving. And I think it's problematic when you start doing that. And I would disagree with both of those statements. I don't think this is the time to do that. I think there's too much disagreement about some of these controversial issues. Libraries are there to provide information, to let people make up their own minds. They don't need to be making their minds up for them. And I think when you start doing that, you get into some really turbulent waters very quickly.
And they talk about librarians rushing to save climate data, say, or scientific data. I mean, are you seeing any of this? Are you seeing censorship or information being destroyed, Todd?
No, I'm not seeing it in my environment, but I do understand the sentiment. That's one area where I might depart a little bit from Mark's comments. Whereas it would trouble me for individual or even institutional activism, as he pointed out, saving the information to me is part of our mission. It's part of our preservation role. Our function includes the necessity to...
But no one's destroying it. No one's telling you to destroy the information.
No, and I don't...
But what she's saying is that the librarians now have to take an active role to resist.
Yeah, if I were in a situation where I thought that loss of information was inevitable or was underway, I might see that role coming forward. No, we don't. We don't actively take a role.
Then why are the librarians so exercised about this right now?
I think a lot of people in the United States are exercised right now, and librarians are just part of the macro group.
Well, Ava, librarians have always benefited so much from such widespread support across all political spectrums. So do you see any danger in this new activism?
I don't feel comfortable with it. We do have really important, impactful roles in regarding privacy and copyright and scope and a lot of our efforts. But to be the activists, I don't feel it is a role that serves us well currently. I think we just keep making sure people are able to make their own decisions. And I think that's the role we've been best at, is making sure that people have all sides of a subject and are prepared for the conversation.
Just to piggyback that a little bit, we have a long history of societal benefit. And we have a brand, mm-hmm. and the brand can get damaged. It's possible. So I think focusing on our core mission is what we are best to do.
Yeah, I would see that it's very similar to when a librarian in a community makes a stand for a particular kind of book that must be preserved no matter what. You get one half of the community up in arms on one side, one half up in arms on the other side. And I've seen it too many times where what typically happens is the library ends up suffering, and that person who is dean or director of that library ends up moving somewhere else. So I don't know that it helps to make those lines in the sand. You've got to remember that you're serving the people.
That's Mark Y. Herring, the Dean of Library Services at Winthrop University and the author of the book, Are Libraries Obsolete? I've also been talking to Todd Chavez, Dean of Libraries for the University of South Florida, and Ava Eady, the Manatee County Public Library Service Manager and 2017 Librarian of the Year, named by the Florida Library Association. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Be sure to leave your comments and questions on our website, wusfnews.org. Just click on the Florida Matters tab. You can also go there to check out some pictures of some of the libraries that we talked about today. Our producer is Stephanie Colombini. Engineer is Tyler Klein. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sessingham. Thanks for listening.